My name is Dick Kammerer, and I haven't met quite a few of you. I'm professor of art, chairman of the art department at Valparaiso University, which is not in South America, as most people believe. It's in Indiana. In fact, I wish it were in South America, but it's in Indiana. I am an artist, a designer of churches, a builder of stained glass windows, and a teacher. In fact, we're going to talk about one thing for the next 2 days in four sessions. This evening, we're going to deal with the relationship of architecture to the church as it was. And tomorrow morning, we're going to deal with the relationship between architecture and the church as it is. And then tomorrow evening, about this time, we'll deal with the relationship between art and the church as it was. And Saturday morning, we will deal with art and the church as it is. Now, I realize that architecture and art really do fit into one general bag, except there is so much. I tried one night up here about a month ago to do the whole thing from the catacombs to Corbusier in 45 minutes, and I got diarrhea of the mouth. Everything was just spilling out in great big abstract generalities, and I can't imagine that anybody got anything out of that more than just some interesting looks at some slides. So I thought, Carol thought I ought to spread that out a little on the first week of my sabbatical. Carol does that to people who are on sabbaticals, you know, and so we've got these extra projects to do. But this is what I'm doing. In fact, for those of you that might be interested, you're perfectly welcome to come up to Chalet 4 and bop in on me while I'm working. My project as during my sabbatical year, I'm spending the year here at the Village, is to do something I don't think has been done since the monks in Lindisfarne during the 600s and 700s. And that is to do the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, word for word. I'm going through all four Gospels, one word at a time, and accompanying the text with illustrations, so that it will be four new manuscripts of the Gospel. Well, okay. And it's really exciting. I started with Matthew yesterday, and yesterday I got as far as and he shall save his people from their sin. And today I got as far as the birth of Christ and the coming of the wise men. And tomorrow I plan on getting as far as the flight into Egypt. And it's just really kind of neat seeing words down on your little paper and trying to fit words and images together. It's just super exciting.
How far will it be a week from Thursday?
Pardon?
How far will it be a week from Thursday?
Well, I'll tell you then. depends on how many of you come up to visit.
I'll leave you alone.
Okay. I hope you can all see this. It's really interesting. The more you look at your own church, the more you understand the nature of how the whole system of church history and your relationship to it works. It's really interesting to see these things in their original context. an awful lot of things which we assume to be the way things need to be in our own time now are not at all the way they assume them to be. I am currently sitting, if you can imagine such, it's almost like being in purgatory. I am sitting on 17 building committees at this particular time, right now. And one building committee, if any of you have ever been on a church building committee, how many of you have been on? Not, look at that. Just a couple, not too many. Oh, four of you. Well, the rest of you are blessed. You've managed to avoid it. What could be one of the most, and I'm sure for some of you has been, one of the most delicious experiences of your life, usually winds up to be pure pain and anguish. And I think primarily the reason is that most of us are working within a very limited tradition. Most of us go back, everyone says, all 17 of these committees say, give me a church that looks like a church. I don't care what else you do with it, just make sure it looks like a church. And so I start in on my lecture with these congregations, all 17 of them, giving them all these pictures of churches and asking them to pick which one they think a church really looks like. There's very few of the churches in the history of the Christian church have much in common, maybe besides a cross. That may be the one common denominator. And then if we use the cross as a common denominator, we'd have to deny that the catacombs were churches because they didn't use the cross at all. In fact, in the catacombs, I'm just showing you this because I want to let you know I'm not avoiding the catacombs. This isn't an example of architecture. It's a scrawling on a catacomb wall. The catacombs are not what we might consider architecture. In fact, the art there is of really very little artistic value. It does not extend the development of art that was existing at that time. And that's reasonable. Here were a bunch of people that were running down into these burial places underground because they were places of safety. Not places of safety because nobody knew they were under there. I mean, isn't that, can you imagine people walking around sprawling fish in the sand and one guy sprawling a fish and another guy looking at him and say, gotcha, okay, now I know who you are, don't tell anybody, and for heaven's sake, don't let the Roman police know, you know. This little fish mark that says, I'm a Christian, and we're going to meet tonight in the catacombs. Well, Rome was going downhill, I'll grant you, but 5,000-6,000 people meeting in a night in the catacombs, I'm sure that the Romans knew the officials knew they were down there. The only reason that they didn't go after them was because it was off limits. Couldn't arrest anybody in a cemetery. It was illegal. It was against Roman law. So in spite of what Cecil B. DeMille says about sneaky early Christians, to the contrary, it was just simply one of the facts that this was a place of safety. Or, as we have come to know, have another word for place of safety, it was a sanctuary. Okay. The art, can you imagine also the early Christians all getting together and saying, hey, you guys and gals, we're all early Christians. And we're going to build some churches, and we are going to decorate some walls and some catacombs. How should we do it? And one guy stands up, he's probably the poet, and he says, let's do it in early Christian. You know, well, how absolutely ridiculous can you get? Except that if you look at the history books today, you got a whole chapter called Early Christian, you know. I had a course until it took me I realized it was taking me about 2 to 3 weeks to apologize for the name of the course. A course called Christian Art, and by the end of the third week I had told all the students in the class, I have come to the conclusion there is no such thing as Christian art. That there may be art that is done for the Christian church, or that there may be art that is done by Christian people, or there may be art that is done with Christian subject matter, but I don't think you can call a piece of art Christian. Well, if you're talking about the word Christian, you're talking about Christ in the middle. And Christ did not say, where two or three paintings are gathered in my name, there am I in the midst. You can talk about Christian people, but I have a real problem talking about Christian art. Okay, so these guys did not get together, at least as far as I know, because my imagination doesn't stretch that far, and say, let's do something in early Christian. No, in fact, they did something in late Roman. on account of the early Christians in Rome were late Roman. Or if the early Christians were in Jerusalem, they did something in middle Jerusalem. That was their style. That was their technique. Or if they did something in Alexandria, Egypt, they did it in a style that we have come to know as Middle Attic. And it has nothing to do with Christian at all. Christians just came along. They just started. And what were they going to do when they wanted to meet, when they wanted to get together somewhere? They said, where are we going to meet? Let's assume they have all now become officialized. It's okay to meet, you guys. You can come up now. Constantine says, you can get out of the catacombs and do your thing on top of the ground now. And the Christians all get together and they say, wow. We can get together. We used to be worshiping in houses. You know, Lydia's house in the book of Acts, she had all the people in the house. But man, we got 10,000 people here and Lydia is just running out of meat and cheese. And we can't continue to bop in on Lydia every Sunday. Let's try something bigger. Well, they didn't start building because there were bigger things already there. And they were built by the Romans. And they were called basilicas. So early Christian architecture is a basilica, and the early Christians did not invent it. The late Romans invented it. In fact, the late Romans didn't invent it. They got it from the Middle Greeks. The Greeks had a basilica form too. The basilica, and that's a little tiny one over there, the basilica is important. But there's something even more important than the building, and that is where it's built. The early Christians, and you can imagine this, let's say that we're in this room, and we're all in a catacomb, okay? Get your minds cooking here. We're all in a catacomb, and we have just gotten a letter. We're in Rome, underground. We just got a letter. Probably we'll call that letter an epistle to the Romans. That's us, okay? And we're going to build a whole service around this on account of we didn't get letters from the Apostle Paul every day. We've got a special gathering here, and here is the Apostle Paul, and he's sending us a letter. Why is it so special to have a letter from the Apostle Paul? Oh, golly, you can imagine. The Apostle Paul was kicked off his horse on the road to Damascus. That's big. I mean, this was the man that got reached directly from heaven. This ray of light came down and blinded him, and he had this conversion experience. The Apostle Paul was in on the execution of Saint Stephen. This man was near the spot. There were some even more important people than Paul, for that matter, because Paul never really got to see Christ. Can you imagine getting a letter from Peter? From Peter? Could you imagine that? Here we are in this catacomb, and Peter... We're converts. Most of us are probably Jews. Huh? We're Jews or we're pagans. We're pagan slaves. And we have been converted. And that conversion sets us right in the middle of a whole lot of bad stuff. Bad, well, sure it's bad. What are we doing underground in this damp, icky, pooey deal? You know, who needs all this? Who needs it? So we get a letter from Peter, or James, or John. And these guys were special, good, neat guys because they were right there. They were in the upper room. They were on the Transfiguration Mountain. They were behind the locked door when Jesus came a-knocking and had guys sticking their fingers in the wounds in his side. These were the people that were right there who touched the center of our new faith. Now you know, I don't know how many of you are converts. I don't even know how many of you are Christians. But having done a whole lot of buildings for a whole lot of people, I can tell you right now, the wildest, the most enthusiastic people are mission congregations where a majority of these people are newly converted to the faith. There is nothing that they won't do. They will give 20% of their income. They are so anxious to build the church. They are so anxious not to be a mission congregation anymore, but to be on their own. There is nothing quite so zealous as a convert. And a convert that's got the word from the guy who was right next to the man from Galilee. Woo! Oh, is that fantastic. Now, you didn't always have these people. The letters sort of pooped out gradually. You know, guys were getting hung upside down on crosses, and they were getting run through with spears. We had a whole lot of people just dying right and left, and the letters started stopping from these direct sources. But we had a direct source, you and I, in this catacomb, we've got a direct source that cannot die. And what is it? It's a place. It's a place. A geographical location. Like, the best place of them all. Jerusalem. There was a plot of ground where Jesus was put into the tomb and where he rose from the dead. That place was a witness to the actions of God in the world. There was a place where Jesus said to Peter, "Thou art Peter, and upon this rock will I build my church." There was a place where Peter was in prison in Rome. There was a place where Mary and Martha had Jesus over for supper one night. There was a place where Lazarus was risen. There was a place where Jesus met the woman at the well. All these places. And so what you had was, in the early Christian church, what is called the cult of the martyria. Martyria, word martyr. Most of us tend to think of that as being some guys that got killed because of their faith. Nope. The early meaning of the word martyr is witness. Witness. And not just people were witnesses. Places were witnesses. The ground you stand on is holy ground, Jesus, God said at the burning bush. Take off your sandals. Well, the whole Middle East concept of place is very important. And they had an iconography of place. And as soon as Christianity was blessed by Constantine, Constantine's mother, who must have been one of the heavy mothers in all of history, started going from place to place, putting little X's on spots. She would find all of these places. And on top of these spots, they would build the basilica. A basilica to honor the place. Thou art Peter, and upon this rock. We're not only going to have this basilica, we're going to have this rock coming right up through the floor. Not going to level it, not going to put grass on it, not going to do anything to it, because it's the rock that was the witness to the actions of Jesus and his disciples in that particular place. So place was extremely important. We don't have that too much anymore. Sense of place. We really don't. First of all, we are constantly on the move. So we don't, you know, I just got done, it was within the last year, of turning down a job for a congregation in a little town in Iowa, central Iowa, population 9,000. And the Lutheran Church came over and said, Kemmerer, you're to be the architect, you're to be the designer, you're to design the bulletin covers, vestments, paraments, even the board out in front that says we're the church, you know, what the name of the church is and when the services are. And I flew over to that little town and I set my plane down and I drove over to the little spot where they wanted to build, the place where they wanted to build. It was on an intersection in the middle of town, and I looked across, it was a Lutheran congregation that wanted to build. I looked across the intersection, and there was another Lutheran congregation that had already built. I looked across the other intersection, there was another Lutheran congregation that had built 2 years before, and I looked across the other intersection, there was a third Lutheran church. Four Lutheran churches they wanted on four corners of one intersection in a town of 9,000. And I said, I'm not going to worship in your church this morning. I'm going to go across the street and worship in that one. And they said, okay, we're not paying for the trip anyway. Go worship at the church of your choice, you know, which is a silly thing to say. But I went over and I went into this new church, 2 years old. Pastor stood there in front of a facility that held something like 550, and there were 43 people sitting in there. And I went back to this congregation that had hired me to build, and I said, you either figure out some way, and I'll be happy to help you, of getting in on that building over there, or I want nothing to do with you. You see, the only thing that was important to them was to build. It wasn't their place that was important. It was in fact important for them to be set apart, to have a place which was unique just for them, which nobody, and I guarantee you, they would have been very unsatisfied with any design that I had done, unless it was taller, bigger, fancier, in some way better than all those other three places. We just don't seem to have a sense of place. But the early Christians, they needed it. It was part of their faith life. So they went to Jerusalem and they built, this kind of neat, they built this little round building over the Holy Sepulchre, and right next to it they built the basilica. That's a basilica format, and there was a little courtyard in between. It's amazing, in Jerusalem, all these little X marks the spots, they're all kind of jammed and crammed and overlapping on one another. Now, from that time on, that little rotunda, you see it there, the round building, there's a floor plan of it. Here it is again. We're going to see something tomorrow night that they picked up at the rotunda of the Anastasis, and those were souvenirs, little vials, and it showed the rotunda of the Anastasis on it, and it would show a picture of Christ, and these little things would go scooting all over Christianity. It wasn't just enough to build churches; you had to go and see them. You had to go and visit those places. That was part of the cult of the martyria of the early Christian church. And this is one of the major reasons for the Crusades later on. This cult of the martyria, to wrest that place from the hands of the infidels, to rescue it and restore it to Christendom. Now, these basilicas then, that were in existence, they're not early Christian inventions, although the early Christians changed them a lot. They come in all kinds of shapes and sizes, but they have a few very important things in common. All basilicas have a flat roof. All basilicas have a clerestory. A clerestory is this little area. You see where the side comes up to the center nave wall? Just above that space and the roof is a row of windows. That's called the clear story. The development of architecture, of almost all architecture, from the time of the early Christians until the Renaissance in the West, is the development of the clear story. That's kind of neat. You could do a whole, you could do a doctoral dissertation. I don't know of one. Any of you interested in art or the Christian church or whatever, and you happen to write a doctoral dissertation someday, do something on the development of the clear story. You could define the whole history of architecture from the year 350 to the year 1501, based solely on how big those windows got and how far apart they got. The development of art and its relationship to the church is not simply the development of God's relationship to man, not purely. It is also the development of engineering techniques. It's the invention, the development of the intervention between the East and the West. It's the development of the intervention and coming together of the Hebrews and the Romans, or better yet, the Hebrews and the Greeks. Those two traditions coming together. So, that's what you have in order to have a clear story. In order to have a basilica, you got the clear story, a flat roof, you got a center that's called the nave, you got two side aisles and sometimes maybe five side aisles. At the far end, you've got a curve, which is called the apse. And it is a longitudinal building. That means it is linear. It is on a line. It's got a front and a back. Okay? And sometimes they're very small, and sometimes they're humongous. This is a model of the original St. Peter's in Rome. And it was a basilica to end all basilicas. It was just gorgeous. And why? Why a basilica called St. Peter's in that place? Because St. Peter was buried there. Iconography of place.
See, now you're saying that they had a flat roof.
This? Yeah, no, a flat ceiling.
Oh, alright.
Yeah, no, this. Yeah. So when you look in up into it, you are not looking at a vault or a dome or something of that sort. I'm sorry, yeah, you're right. It's a flat ceiling. And of course, in order to get that clear story farther apart, to accommodate more people and to get rid of all the wood up there, because these basilicas were burning down like crazy. It gets very hot up there and it's all timber and they were just collapsing. Well, you don't want to go to church in the morning and have your roof fall in on you, you know. And besides that, we were all out there in the side aisles. The way the early Christians worshipped, it was really kind of fascinating. They had the men, like the Missouri Synod. They had the men on one side and the women on the other. And the men were over here and the women were over here. And the confirmands were in the middle. And the bishop sat in his chair. If this was a cathedral, the bishop sat in his chair. The bishop's chair is called a cathedra. If you don't have a bishop's chair, you don't have a cathedral. Isn't that neat? Yeah, so the cathedra, the bishop's chair, could be in some dinky, dinky little thing. It could be in some really, you know, if you got a poor little thing like down in southern Italy, they couldn't build one of these fantastic things. They build a little kind of tiny basilica, and they put the bishop's chair, probably something like this, in there. And that was a cathedral. It was. St. Peter's is not a cathedral. How's that grab you, folks? You thought you were going into a cathedral. It isn't. Who's the Bishop of Rome? The Pope. The Pope does not have his chair in St. Peter's. He's got his chair in St. John Lateran. St. John Lateran is the Cathedral of Rome. They get around that a little bit. How many of you have been to St. Peter's? Anybody been to St. Peter's? You know, on the far back wall, there's this glorious burst and the dove and the chair, the little stool of St. Peter's. St. Peter's chair himself, the first bishop of Rome. So on that basis, they refer to St. Peter's as a cathedral ex officio, which is like a cop-out. Okay. And, well, there's the inside of St. Peter's. This was huge. 10,000 people could stand in there. Notice, no pews. I want you to notice how little they got in these churches, folks. The whole Christian church got along for an awful long time without pews, stained glass, and organs. Oh, for centuries without any of those goodies, and yet if you try and build a church now without any of those things, you're some sort of a heretic. So flat, still the flat ceiling in there, but just gigantic. And they wound up with some cute ones too, some really, this one, San Lorenzo. San Lorenzo outside the walls, built right next to the catacombs. St. Lawrence is buried there. St. Lawrence, who was a martyr, because he was barbecued to death. He was put on a grill, and then he was buried in the catacombs and was a very popular saint in the early church. And here is the basilica once again. Flat roof, but this is a dog leg. This is one of the funniest basilicas in all of Christendom. In fact, they found that they walked into church and they built this little grotto. Iconography of place. Place. You got to get down to St. Lawrence. Get as close to him as possible. So you have a grotto down there around the tomb. Well, they built the grotto and they found that they had slightly erred in their building plan, and St. Lawrence wasn't anywhere around down there. And so they just kept right on building. they built a basilica, and this was supposed to be the end of it. And St. Lawrence was supposed to be down here, but he wasn't. So they kept building and they put two basilicas together. And so here you've got one basilica that goes this way, and there's another basilica that just keeps right on going. And you can get to St. Lawrence from two different directions at the same time. And it's really, but it's a dog leg. They didn't line them up right on account of the catacombs were underneath. And so they couldn't build in a straight line, otherwise the church would have fallen into this hole in the ground. So they lined them up at a slight angle, like that. So you got a basilica coming this way, and another basilica coming that way. And it's kind of neat.
Do they still stand in those churches?
Oh, yes. Yeah, they still stand. In fact, once again, the pews are very small. They won't take care of a normal congregation. But here, instead of having the men on one side and the women on the other, they have the men down here and the women up here. But you got to separate them. There's just no question about that. Look at these gigantic basilicas, but they still keep that same format. There's the clear story. This is St. Mary Major, and that's St. Paul's outside the walls. And there's another clear story. See the little, just a few little benches in there? And where did the early Christian, can you look at the early Christian columns?
And St. Paul's without the walls?
St. Paul's outside the walls. The other one was San Lorenzo outside the walls. Why outside the walls? You could not bury anybody inside the wall. Nobody is buried inside the walls of an old town. You always bury them outside. The catacombs are outside the walls. So if you're going to have a cult of the martyria, your stuff's going to wind up being outside the walls, most of it, where the people are buried. No, those early Christians, they ripped all that stuff off of late Roman stuff. In fact, they got some stuff off of the Greeks. So remember this now, we're in the West, and we're operating with a longitudinal format. It's a basilica form, and the early Christians, just like the late Christians, if you want to take a lesson from them, the tradition has already been established with this architecture. You make good use out of what is available. You build out of what you know, and you build for your time. This is probably one of the finest examples of an early Christian basilica that's still in still standing. This is in Ravenna, or just outside of Ravenna, San Apollinare Nuovo. We covered things with mosaic. Mosaic was not an invention of the early Christians. The Romans covered all kinds of stuff with gorgeous mosaic. The early Christians adapted it, and they began to pull some symbolism out. But if you look at those, at these little works of art here, that could be in a in the baths of Caracalla on the wall. The Romans were doing things very much like that, with the sheep and everything, with the peaceable kingdom, the whole schmear. Now we got a whole different thing. On account of Constantine allows the Christians to come up above ground to officialize them, but he does his thing in Constantinople. And that's another, Constantinople is not Rome. Constantinople has the great golden horn running through it, and it's two cities in one, and one half of it is in Europe, and the other half, which is Ushkarada, is in Asia. There's a big town which is half Asian and half European. And the solutions to a style that is worthy for Christendom in this place has to be relevant to the place where it's located. And one of the most beautiful things that was done in Byzantium is this building, which is called the Hagia Sophia, the Church of the Holy Wisdom, built by Justinian in the first golden age. And it is so incredible, it is so gigantic, it is so monumental that you don't even know where you are when you're in it, because there is nothing that is human about its scale. These are minarets which were added later, but one of the first reactions you might have is how much it looks like a mosque. Well, there's a good reason for that, and one might draw some conclusions that the early Christians copied mosques, and that isn't true. The Islams copied the early Christian. This came before the mosque, and the mosques, the Islamic people, when they took over this town, were so impressed by the architecture that they decided to build their places of worship and model them after early Christian solutions in this particular place. That is the narthex of the Hagia Sophia. Everything that you see in that slide is either marble, porphyry, 22 karat gold, or alabaster. Everything. The windows are shaved alabaster. The ceiling is mosaic. The mosaic in the Hagia Sophia, which is almost 60% 22 karat gold, you can measure it by the square acre. And the marble for building the walls of the Hagia Sophia were cut from quarries that were opened specifically for the building of this one building and then dynamited shut. And nobody at this time knows where that marble comes from, and there's no other building that contains marble like this building. As I say, the inside of it just defies human scale. The medallions on the sides are, once again, they are from Islam, and they say there is no God but Allah. Muhammad is his prophet. If you would take the highest cathedral of the Gothic age, which is the cathedral at Beauvais, and put it inside of the Hagia Sophia, it would come up to here before the dome even starts. Not now. It was used. They painted over all of the iconography, over all the images, because Islam could not tolerate images of any kind, and they made a mosque out of it. But the plaster that they painted over it has begun to crumble off, and these mosaics. It doesn't look like it. When I was first there, I was not allowed to photograph this thing. You weren't allowed to take pictures of it, but I didn't. They wouldn't buy it. They wouldn't sell you any pictures either. So I stuck my camera under my armpit, and I shot that way, which probably accounts for the slightly bluish cast. The thing is really much lighter in color. It's much more delicate. But this plaster started falling off, and they saw all this gold mosaic and imagery underneath it. And so they have closed it as a mosque, and it is now a museum called the Museum de Cora. No, you do not have to take your shoes off to go into the Hagia Sophia. But you can see the capital. This is Constantinian. This is unique to this place. It's not just a Doric, Ionic, Corinthian, what have you. It's carved all the way through. I don't know how in the world they did that. They might have had little nut picks and went in there and started crawling around inside the capital there, because it's all interlaced. This is all gold. This is all gold. And they invented, the dome fell in twice. What they were trying to do was put a round dome on top of a square floor plan, and there were a bunch of ways that they had figured out how to do it. One was a squinch, which is sort of like an upside down pyramid, and they finally came up with this device, and it's called a pendantive. There are four. I don't know. I have my own reference to give you an idea of scale. At the Valparaiso Chapel, we have an altar, and around that altar in the chancel area, can stand 75 people and be communed at once. And 300 people can stand around the altar, and we can have a service inside this chancel. It's just a huge round thing, and then the thing goes out like a barn from there. This is one of the four columns of the main nave area. And that column, this really it's not a column, it's a pier. That pier is about the size of our chancel. In other words, 300 people could gather inside of this. Now, we've got four columns. They're shooting straight up, and we want to get a dome. We don't want a dome that's bigger than that, because it would look stupid. Four columns rising up into the middle of a dome. We want the dome to be at the end of those columns. So the dome has to be slightly smaller. It has to fit in there. Now, how do we get a dome to fit inside the area prescribed by those four columns without having it fall in? And the solution invented at this particular time, and it's an engineering solution, people. It's not theological. It's aesthetic and engineering. It's called a pendantive. It goes up, it goes around, and it goes forward all at the same time. It's like an old-fashioned diaper. An old-fashioned, I can't even talk like that anymore. Everything's Pampers. Big, hulky, rectangular, doom. Whatever happened to the old hyperbolic paraboloid diaper, That was, had a little class to it. This is all mosaic. And some of this is blue. Some of it is gold. Actually, the blue is more expensive than the gold because it's made out of cobalt. And cobalt at that time was harder to get than the gold was. And when they really wanted to go crazy, they went in for some red. And you find little red lines around all of this. And the red was made out of mercury, which was about twice as expensive as gold. It took the income from 300 Byzantine estates. A Byzantine estate would be something like the King Ranch. The annual receipts from 300 Byzantine estates to pay for the maintenance of this place. Not the building of it, the maintenance of it. Incredible. Absolutely incredible. And that dome just hovers. It floats. It used to be solid. and it fell in. It was so heavy, it just boom, you know, one Sunday. Justinian walked in there on dedication day after the final dome had been put in, and they lightened it up. It's actually one dome inside of another dome, and there's a big airspace in between. And then they put all of these windows in to lighten it still further, and that dome just looks like it hovers on top. Like some spacecraft that just landed on the top. It's just so delicate. And that's another reason why you don't know where you are when you're inside. It's mammoth. It's gigantic, but it just kind of floats there. And Justinian walked in on the day of dedication, and he said, "Solomon, I have outdone thee." And I think he did. And Byzantium in general was a place that just tried to do its utmost. Just everything was the most. This is San Vitale. We'll talk about this a little tomorrow. This is in Ravenna, and this is a fuzzy slide. There we are. Some of you may have been there, which is also a Byzantine outpost just north of Ravenna. That's St. Mark's in Venice. St. Mark's. Why is it called St. Mark's? Because St. Mark is buried in it. They went over to North Africa and they got the body of St. Mark. The cult of the martyria. It still hung on. But they have a lot of images. We'll talk tomorrow morning about, we'll talk tomorrow night about the icon. But they had an awful lot of problems with the images that the Byzantine people made, and they had these theological controversies. They were just killing each other off. The priests wound up being decimated, killed, slaughtered by people who said, "You can't have images in the church." And so the priests went out into the boonies and tried to hide out. And they went to some of the wildest places you can imagine. And they went here, for example, this is in Meteora, which is in Greece, along the plain of Thessaly. And they this real weird, looks like a moon landscape. And they built little hideouts on top of these rock formations. And this was actually then, the first monastic system. This really began a whole system of monks living out in these nether regions and establishing little communities around them, and the monastic system really started thriving during the iconoclastic controversy in Byzantium. They'd have to lower their guys and their food and everything up and down the side of these cliffs. There's one, that's the Varlam Monastery. I spent a week up there. It's just the most gorgeous place you can imagine.
How did you get up there?
There are little trails now cut out of the rock. And you can, there's one that goes up here, and then they just built a little bridge. They finally got those monks out of that place, the people that were chasing them. The Turks got them out by threatening to dynamite the bottom of the cliff. Send the whole thing down. But that was the beginning of the monastic community. Now, Byzantium goes on forever. I don't know of a university that offers a decent course in Byzantium, but it starts in around 350, and it winds up with the last emperor of Byzantium paying a visit to Lorenzo de' Medici. Holy cow! Lorenzo de' Medici sees the Byzantine emperor, John Palaeologus, coming with his whole retinue. And he's got a Chinese philosopher in the court, he's got a North African mathematician, he's got an astronomer, a calligrapher, a cartographer. All of these things are in the court of the emperor. Well, Palaeologus took his whole retinue. He wanted to impress the Pope at Rome and give him some help. I got these people coming down on my heads from the north. Will you get them off of me? Send me some army. Send me some money. Do something. And the Pope says, "You split the church, you rascal. Now you just stewing your own juices. But there's a guy up north. He owns a bank and a lot of woolen mills. Maybe he'll help you out. Go see Lorenzo and tell him I sent you. He's my cousin." And so Palaeologus goes up north. And Lorenzo de' Medici says, I can't help you. I really don't believe in your cause. Besides, I got a few things here cooking myself, and I got to throw a lot of money in it. But I sure do like the looks of your court. I mean, these guys walking around with all of their knowledge and ability. I do like that. You mind if I copy it? And Paleologus says, well, sure, go ahead, copy it. And but don't give me any credit. And so sure enough, Lorenzo de' Medici starts a whole school. And in the school, he has people that are teaching astronomy, that are teaching foreign language, that are teaching art, that are teaching culture, that are teaching science, that are teaching all of these things that he got from the court of the Byzantine Empire. And what he called it was the humanities. How's that grab you? Our whole university system, which goes back to the Renaissance, based on Paleologus needing some money from Lorenzo de' Medici. We are heir to an awful lot of Byzantium, and we just don't, and nobody ever listens. Nobody pays any attention to it. A tremendously long-lasting time in history. And romantic. Anybody that couldn't get excited about Empress Theodora, the Empress of Byzantium, who in her early childhood was a prostitute and a bear trainer. Now, man, what a book. What a book that'd make. How'd you like to have a prostitute and a bear trainer running the United States for a couple years? She did a tremendous job. Her husband, you know, was Justinian, and yeah, she couldn't do worse. Huh? But her husband was Justinian, and he was writing laws and doing a whole bunch of other stuff, and she was at home taking care of the kingdom. Okay, now, Byzantium goes on for a long time, poops out towards the end of its life. Christendom goes on, but it takes all kinds of different forms. You've got the wandering tribes, you've got the Goths, the Visigoths, the Ostrogoths, you've got them coming over, you've got Islam. Islam tries to destroy Byzantium so that it can cut across Europe and get to the center of Europe in a real hurry. And so it meets the Byzantine navy in the Bosphorus, and Byzantium wipes them out. They just destroy the Islamic navy down to every single boat, lifeboat, man and oar, and they're left without a boat to paddle. And so Islam cannot go across Europe, it's got to go across North Africa. A whole pile of history there. And it finally gets up to Europe, gets into Central Europe by going across North Africa and the Straits of Gibraltar up through Spain, which is an awful lot Islamic, huh? The southern Spain, fantastic. The Alhambra, Knights in the Gardens of Spain, it's like Islam practically. They keep going up and up and up to France. Where do they finally end up? Where does Islam, how far does Islam get in Europe? See what I mean, people? It's so exciting. It's the reason why art is what it looks like, because Islam is there. Boy, there's all those Christians in Spain. And the Islamic people come and they say, you ought to try Christianity. You'd like it. And some of the Islamic people do. And the Islamic people get converted to Spanish Christianity and develop an art form called Mozarabic, which is one of the wildest, most gorgeous art styles you ever saw in your life. It's art that looks like Persian rugs. It's just fantastic. You know, Islam gets all the way up to Poitiers, and the man that puts him down finally, once and for all in Europe, Charles Martel. No? Oh, come on. That's super exciting. It's just tremendous. And Islamic things, the Islamic influence winds up in monasteries, it winds up in the fronts of churches. Oh man, you gotta know that. The monastic system, during all of this migration of the tribes, during the destruction of Rome, during the plague, during all of this stuff, the monastic system is really what holds it together. And one guy around the year 800 that probably is the guy most people give the credit to for keeping Europe intact. Who? Charlemagne. Why didn't you say so? Yeah, Charlemagne. And of course his ancestors come from all these wandering tribes. Pepin the Short. Yeah. Pepin the Short was the father of Charlemagne. Charlemagne had another brother, and the other brother wound up down in a monastery in southern Italy. And ran that monastic community, but Charlemagne ran everything else in the whole world just about at that time. The monastic community really gets its start, and we're going to see some art that covers a great period in here, like Irish art, monastic art. Oh, is that gorgeous? The book, the invention of the book. People were moving around so much they didn't have time to call a building committee together. You know, and they're not going to sit together and say, well, let's build and get our mortgage set for the next 35 years, because 35 years from now, who needs a building? We're going to be someplace else. We're going to be in the middle of France. So let's concentrate on the book. That we can just stick under our arm. So the arts were portable. And there were a couple other things, reasons why people didn't want to build. One reason was the year 1000. Nobody wanted to build close to the year 1000. And the reason for that was this fellow over here with the wings. The angel Michael was going to come down in the year 1000, blow on the horn, and say, that's all she wrote, folks. This is the end. You know, you are coming with me. This is what we will call the millennium. Now cut out your building programs. Don't, you know, no more books. It's everybody up. And way up, all the way up, you know, that's it. Nobody's going to build a cathedral in the year 999. You know, nobody, it's ridiculous. But the year 1001 came, and people were beginning to wonder. You know, they were looking at their calendar watches, and they were saying, hey, my, you know, maybe Michael is not coming. And they waited until 1002. 1003, they figured maybe their calendar and God's calendar were not the same calendar. And then the year 1004 came and they said, that's it, folks. He must have been thinking of something else. Let's start building and dedicate what we're going to build to the angel Michael. Let's build our monasteries bigger and better and have whole kinds of religious communities dedicated to thanking Saint Michael and God for favors granted. And so they did. And the monasteries went like crazy. They went like crazy. This little thing, which is still built like a basilica, this is the age called the Romanesque. And this is a huge basilica, but it's an abbey church. Means it's in the middle of a monastery. And it was a sister. It was the mother house of a whole bunch of sister monastic communities. That there were 300 of them. This is Cluny. And the Cluniac order consisted of 300 monasteries. The wealth, the power, the whole stability of Europe at this time rested in these hands. Whenever the people were in trouble in the village, they went to the monastery. When there were left the people that were wandering around Europe, knocking off, you know, raping, pillaging, whatever you do if you're wandering around and haven't got a place, everybody ran into the monastery. So they built their monastery churches kind of like rather severe, you know, so you could pour boiling oil down on the Christmas carolers or whoever happened to be knocking on your door. If you didn't want to see them, you get rid of them. The monasteries at Romanesque times, they were really like fortresses. Ein Festeburg. And some of them were small, and some of them were humongous. Some of them were really, really big. This is Mainz. And there was so much excitement going on because it was kind of like free time. They were finding new wealth, new reasons for living, new existences. And so they were starting to invent. If you look at a Romanesque church, the guides to these things will just simply tell you, this is the year the tower fell down. This is year, the year the ceiling fell in. This is year, the year that the east wall collapsed. You know, they just had to build, and they really were not all that, you know, they didn't quite know how to go about doing it. They wanted to get that clear story bigger, and they couldn't do it. And they had to get the space wider, and if you got a wider space, that means you can't use a flat beam across it. So you had to use a curved arch. And if you've got a curved arch in a wide space, you've got such pressure against the outside wall that you got to pile up all this, look at all this solid masonry. So most of what you get in a Romanesque church is solid masonry because the engineers haven't quite figured out how to get that space wider and yet lighter. So we can get some light in there and still get it big enough to get our people together. And they figured out all kinds of strange things to do. They usually would run a vault going this way, down the longitudinal way, with a barrel vault, like so. But here was a church that decided to, you know, that there was all that weight on the outside if we had a barrel vault running this way, so let's run the barrel vaults the other way. And we'll just, like that, down the aisle. Just one little half a loop after the other. And it's kind of cute. It worked. They didn't have to pile so much masonry on the outside. But it is a dumb-looking church. It really looks stupid. It looks like it's, you know, almost get seasick walking down the aisle, going from one little section, one little bay to the other. And there's no sense of this longitudinal thing. So much fun. Romanesque, this is part of it. You're all familiar with it. But look at the silly. Look at the silly business here. They're starting off with some nice cream and green marble. Pretty. Then somebody must have discovered a vein of pink stuff, and they said, all right, I like it pink. You know? So halfway down the wall, they start doing it in pink. You know? It's nice. I like it. Put it up there. Look at, we got an arch, a blind arcade going down with a certain kind of spandrel space. The spandrel is the space between the top of the arch and this cornice line here. And they're going down there, and all of a sudden, whoever decided they wanted pink decided they wanted a whole different spandrel. So they just move that up too. They come down here, and we've got nice rhythm. Nice little window blank. We're going to put a window in there. It wouldn't have hurt nothing. It would have opened on to something, but the guy said, I'm getting tired of this window blank, window blank, window blank. Let's make it window blank, blank. Here they put a window. And there's nothing in there. That opens onto a space which is 8 inches wide. There is absolutely nothing on the other side of that window. On the other side of this, there's a facade like this on the other side. One of these little columns is a dog leg to the right. It just leans like that. And it's not like it fell over. I mean, the base is down here and the top is up here. There's no way you could straighten it out. It's too long. They just said, this is neat. And we're getting tired of all the like that. In the north, in a town called Bologna, they've got 7 towers downtown and every one of them leans in a different direction. And they were built to tilt. They were built to tilt, and I got a hunch that the guy that started this had something like that in mind too. I really, I, not everybody agrees with me on this, but I really believe this thing started out as an angle, at an angle. Because when you get up toward the top, you'll notice that these columns start straightening out. There's a slight curve in that whole thing. And if you could see some of the other stuff, you know where the ceiling is running this way instead of that way? They've got a beautiful chapel in the side aisle. See here, the ceiling's, the little vault is going this way. Along in the side aisle, at the end of the side aisle, they've got a chapel. And the chapel is about 23 inches deep. There's nothing in it. And you come out of the chapel, and you take one step, two steps, and the next step is a killer. It will absolutely wipe you out. There's no way that you can get up there, and there's no reason to go up there in the first place because there's nothing there. In Pisa, they have a, over the main altar, they've got a balcony. And it works. It's carved marble, handrails, steps going up. And you have to jump 17 feet in order to get onto the first step from the side out. You just take this run if you feel like it. But let me tell you, don't bother on account of you go up the handrail to the door, which is at the top of the stairs, and it's painted on the marble. The door is painted on the marble. It's as flat as the back of your hand. This is right down the street from Pisa. Look at that. Every single one of those columns is different. Every single, they got some curlicue ones, they got straight ones, octagonal, every single one of those is different. It was just a happy time. Look at that step. Well, that's a ridiculous step. Pardon? Oh, I wouldn't blame it. You make it sound like somebody ought to be guilty for it. I think it's, that's play. That's what, you know, we were talking about the other, it's just foolishness. And boy, I think more building committees ought to get involved in pure, simple foolishness. So when we finally get to the Gothic Age, they have gone through all of this. They are heir to the Romanesque. The Romanesque people have tried absolutely everything to get that ceiling to work, and they finally have resolved it. I'll tell you how they resolved it. In a ribbed quadripartite groin vault. I'm not going to go into that, obviously. The hour grows late. But they did solve it, and then the Gothic people came along, and they put it all together in one piece. The Romanesque age gets so shortchanged, 200 years from the year 1000 to 1200, and it was 200 years of pure delight in Germany, France, and Italy. And you hear very, very little about it. And as a result, we call the Gothic Age the Age of Faith because they built all this marvelous stuff. Not so. Not so. This was the age of faith. These were the people that were experimenting and trying to celebrate. Mrs. Sharp. And instead of all the goodies on the inside, now the Gothic churches are beginning to put all the stuff that they believe, the stuff that they acknowledge, on the outside of their churches. And all of the craft, all of the wisdom, all of the theology is taking shape, it's taking form in glass, in light. Abbot Suger at Saint-Denis, a little suburb of Paris, was the guy that started it all. And he said, I want more light. It was almost like the dawn of creation. And he had the engineers knock out the whole choir end of his chapel and put in glass. And it worked. It just stood there. And instead of working in great big arches, which needed all that masonry piled on the outside, they found that when the arch broke and you had two arcs, one leaning up against the other, that the weight went down into the column instead of out. they didn't have to pile all that masonry up. And if they didn't have to pile all the masonry up, they could open up those walls and put in light. And that's what they've done here. So you've got little buttresses like this, and that's all you need to hold up those walls, and in the spaces in between, you've got the windows. Various places took it and made different forms out of it. So France went crazy with limestone. England stayed rather severe, and while France was going up and down, England was going horizontal with its cathedrals. And they brought to the cathedral all that they knew, and the wandering tribes that had come from Siberia and from Asia came in, and the Vikings came down from the north over a period of time and left their mark. And the Gothic age, the age of faith, still put the demons on the ends of its buildings. The good demons. These are good demons. And Beauvais winds up so high that it can't go any higher, and the whole nave falls down, and they're left with only a choir. Ulm copies the French because Gothic is a northern thing. And for some reason, the French knew how to do it, and very few other people did. England knew how to do it pretty good, and Spain knew how to do it eventually. Germany didn't know how to do it so good and tended to copy a lot of France. And Italy was absolutely out of the picture. Totally out of the picture. They wouldn't know Gothic if it bit them in the neck. And the weird thing about this, of course, that most of us still like to acknowledge, that the proper solution to the creation of a spiritual space is Gothic. If that had been true in its own time, one would suspect at least that the closer you get to Rome, the more Gothic you have. And just the reverse is true. Rome is one of the least Gothic cities in the entire world. Boston has much better, very good Gothic architecture in it than Rome does. So it is a phenomenon of a particular place, of a particular people, of a particular geographic location, and of a particular time. And eventually, the architecture disappears entirely, and you are left with nothing but light and color. Oh, I should show that. This will blow your mind. Those of you that have seen Gothic cathedrals, you should now visit Saint-Chapelle in Paris and see how they originally looked. Can you imagine the facades of Reims and Notre Dame of Chartres and Notre Dame of Paris and Amiens and Beauvais in color? They were. They were originally in color, like this. This is stone. This is all stone. Gold and red and blue. All of the figures on the outside of the cathedrals painted with stars, gold on blue backgrounds. It just must have been spectacular. But of course, the limestone out of which all of this is built is so porous, and it just sucked up the color, and the wind and the pollution in general took care of the rest. But that must have been a sight. We have trouble thinking of painting on stone. Dale Hayworth was quick to point out, we get some of our pristine aesthetics from appreciating things like the Parthenon on the Acropolis, you know, and that gorgeous marble. That was all painted. That too was all, the marble was gold and blue and yellow. All of the figures that were carved, the Elgin marbles that were put into the triforium spaces, those were all painted in the most exotic colors you could possibly imagine. Isn't that amazing? Didn't know that, did you? That's what I mean by Italy. Look at Italy. It's still building a basilica. This looks like a Hollywood set. They got that plain old dumpy basilica, but they put this wild candy box front on the front of it. Looks like how we used to make animals when we were a kid, by pasting a pig front and a pig rear on the back of back and front of little spools. Do you ever do that?
Yeah.
Well, the spool for Italian Gothic is the basilica. And along comes the Renaissance, and it puts on a little Renaissance pig front, you know, and puts on a little Gothic pig rear end and stuff. You know, Italy just absolutely did not know what to do with the Gothic age. And even this gigantic, gigantic church in Florence, Italy, is really just that basilica shape. There's the clear story going down there. And they finally hit the Renaissance, which is the rebirth of the classical tradition. And Brunelleschi says, at the crossing, we got to put a dome. And he did it. So we got a basilica with a dome. And we're really back in Byzantium again. And that's what we've got at St. Peter's. Michelangelo's dome is at the crossing of a basilica format. But that basilica thing hung on, there's a basilica with a pure Renaissance front on it. Looks dumb. It's even got the atrium with the baptismal font in the middle of it. Just like the early, just like the first San Apollinario I showed you. The monastic system, this is Michelangelo's facade, a sense of order, of neat arrangement. It looks kind of crummy. That's a Michelangelo. It looks kind of crummy. All that stuff around it, which is unfinished. The reason for that is that his supply of marble, which was coming on a barge down from Carrara, sank in the river. And so he never got to finish the front of that building. Inside, of course, are the Medici tombs, which are one of the high points of Michelangelo's sculpture. The monastic community continues to thrive at the time of the Renaissance, at the time of the Reformation. It becomes more aggressive, and you begin establishing a kind of enclosure arrangement for the church again. So what what you've got in the post-Reformation are the Roman Catholics that are saying, the outside is nothing, and you're going to find your way to heaven on the inside. And we are going to give you the inside. And so an awful lot of architecture and its relationship to the church then became propagandistic. And what was very simple on the outside still left room for a high ceiling so that they could put heaven opening up. You know, if you want to see heaven, you can't go walking around the outside of the cathedral like you did, you know, in the Gothic age. You've got to come against that flat, pristine wall. You come under the judgment. You walk into the arena where heaven is accessible.
That's Church in the Meadow.
This is Vif, which is at the very bottom of the Romanicus Hochstrasse. So eventually, the building of the architecture and the art on the interior of the church becomes propagandistic, and eventually, it's the kiss of death, and the church then no longer needs the artist; it just simply uses the artist. There was very little collaboration after this time, and the main